Welcome everyone to Hunt the Habitat. A great dog and a shotgun will only get you so far in the uplands. In this podcast, Ann Jandernoff helps us to attain a more in-depth understanding of the birds we love to hunt, their habits, their habitat, and how those change through the year and through the hunting season. Hunt the Habitat, find the birds. Hi, everybody. This is Hunt the Habitat with Ann Jandernoff, and this is our opportunity to spend some time with one of the recognized authorities on our upland birds, Ann Jandernoff. And as Ann likes to say, the best bird dog in the world and the best shotgun isn't going to get you success if you don't understand the bird you're hunting and its needs. Hunt the habitat, find the bird. And Ann, it is wonderful to be with you here this evening. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Except we got one problem.
What's that?
It's snowing again.
Why is that not a surprise? It's been that kind of a spring.
Oh, it's crazy. It's just plain crazy. Tonight they've got a weather warning. Winter storm warning. And it's just nuts. So, and they're talking about more snow. And so tonight, 3 to 5 inches with 10 to 20 mile an hour winds. Sunday, 1 to 3 in during the day. And then those dirty buggers. But 1 to 3 in the morning, then I don't know, someone really got wound up and they're calling 3 to 5 Sunday night. Then Monday, oh, they're bad. Another 3 to 5. What the heck? And 1 to 3, Monday night, Tuesday, finally it goes away.
For
this
now.
This is not good.
For now.
Yeah, this looks okay. So let's add this up. 3 to 5 tonight, 1 to 3. This is your department. You're adding.
Okay, 1 to 3.
3 to 5, 1 to 3, 3 to 5, 3 to 5, 1 to 3.
1 to 3. So on the low side, we're looking at 11 inches. On the high side, we're looking at 5, 10, 15, 18, 21 inches of snow.
Oh, my word.
I know.
Well, I needed to buy more groceries. This was the third time I took the plow off of the UTV. That's horrible.
And it's getting to the point now we can't just say, well, that's April in the Northwoods, because it's May. It's going to be May really quick.
And, you know, someone's got their April Fool's joke mixed up on the months.
Yeah, but I think we're the fools. That's the problem.
Oh, my word. So,
you know, it's been a week since we talked, and you've obviously been spending some time out in the woods. What do you see happening prior to everything being disrupted by the snow?
Again.
Again.
Again. Well, I mean, the spring shuffle is finally full bore movement. The birds are shifting and the males are drumming. Found some new areas to hunt. I went and sat down with my maps and I found some of the corridors that I suspected would be there. And I found the birds and I found 4 or 5 in each area. Some of the areas had 3, and then I went a little farther and it connected into another corridor, but it was very close. And the birds were spaced out nice. So I'm finding some new places to hunt. I enjoy walking in there, and you stand there for a little bit, and you hear one, and you hear another one, and then you go a little farther, and you hear another one. And now you start dropping waypoints of approximately where I think it is and the directions. And it just, for me, it just makes it easier to figure out where I want to hunt later in the season. And as we mentioned in the earlier podcast, the hens will, in the mid to late fall, will shift into the male habitat. So for me, doing these counts for myself, and as we also stated, that we're not doing the counts to see how many times they're drumming. We're doing the counts to get an idea of how many birds are in an area.
Drummers versus drumming. We're listening for individual birds. We talked about this on the last podcast. It's a great, great point you made. The more individual birds we hear, the better an indicator it is of habitats that supports birds all year round. Do I have that right?
That's correct. And I think for those that haven't heard the first podcast, is that these males can typically drum every 4 minutes. Let's just say there's 5 birds that are drumming, and when a hen's nearby, one could be drumming every minute or every 2 minutes. So that's the problem. It runs the numbers up, and you have one particular area that has a lot of drumming going on with one particular bird. All it's saying is he's got a hen nearby. That's what it's telling you. So I just know that I do the counts because that's where the hens are going to shift, and that's where I'll end up ultimately spending my time for late season hunting. It lets me, instead of looking for a needle in the haystack, I already know where the needle is in the haystack. Okay. Now, that wasn't a bad analogy. I couldn't have come up with that if I had to write it.
Over-preparation sometimes hurts. You use the term corridor a lot in your conversation. You used that a little bit last week. Could you talk a little bit more about that, just so we really understand what you're talking about when you talk about corridors?
Well, corridor could be habitat, the way the habitat runs. And if you think about it, if the habitat's right, those birds will be in those corridors. It's really transitional habitat between lowland and upland. That's your corridor. If the ground's flat, it's not really as distinguishable okay. as versus an area that has some elevation. So typically, if you have a quick elevation, you basically go from lowland moisture or grass or river or stream or something, then into a transition of possibly conifers. Depending on if you're farther north, you'll pick up more conifers. Whereas if you're farther south, a lot of times that lowland area is just scrappy, tangled brush and lowland area. And then it goes into, for us here, it goes into aspen. And then the aspen forms a transition from the aspen into the hardwoods. So it forms bands around the base of a hill.
Okay.
Let's put it that way. Especially up north here, you form bands. Whereas if the ground's all flat, it's sort of a big aspen area. You don't have a lot of lowland edges unless you have depressions within the aspen cut. You have the outer edge, and you might have the trail edges in there, and maybe a shrub component edge within a flat cut, but you aren't having the long, narrow band that is like a bench that follows the base of the hill okay. around. On one side, you have, you know, the lowland, and the other side, you have the upland, and each one forms a transition between each other. So you'll have the upland, then you have aspen upland combination, and then you have the aspen, and then you have the aspen conifer combination, and then you have the conifer, and then you have the low stuff where you're going to get your feet wet. That's one way to think about it. And especially out east, some of the best areas are going to be just like what I described, maybe not with conifer or maybe with conifer down at the end. It depends on where you're at. Like, say, take New Hampshire and Maine and some of those areas. The best soil's not on top of the hill and way up high. It's where it flares out before it goes into really lowland. Because that's where the best dirt is. And I remember I was with a forester out there out of Bingham. It was when Plum Creek used to own all that property out there. I was at Bingham, Maine, and we were proofing the maps. I had called Plum Creek office from here in Wisconsin, and I happened to know one of the guys that was in Wisconsin, and him and his wife moved back to Maine because she was from actually New Brunswick. So they moved back to Maine, and they were in the Bingham area, which is sort of south of Jackman. The company was really great about saying, hey, we're not going to let you see our data. And people need to understand that's proprietary. I knew they weren't going to, but if they could tell me what some of the ages were of some of the cuts that I liked and what I had mapped, that would be a huge help. And they said that was perfectly fine. They designated the guy to drive me around for a day out there.
That's generous.
In the woods. Yeah. So I saw the logging crews and what they were doing. And it was really a lot of fun for me. Then when we got done, we came back to the office. He says, okay, so which ones do you want to know the harvest year of? And we went through and we checked them. And it was just interesting, because this was the time when I did all that mapping off of Google Earth. So I drove all the way, Skip and I did, from Wisconsin to Bingham, Maine, took the map, and we drove around, and we found every place just about on the map that I had marked up for the first time. And I had never been to Maine. So I wanted to see what the map looked like before I put it on the market. That's what I did. So I found the cuts. The only thing is out in Maine is that many times, let's just say you have a cut in 2000, and then they come back, and in 2003, they assess that cut and say, boy, you know, this cut's 60 acres, and 45 of it is just not regenerating like what we'd like. Okay, we're going to herbicide it all, and we are going to plant pines.
Okay.
My point is that you start out seeing the cut, but you don't know what's happened to the cut because you don't have another right. set of imagery to reference it that would tell you. And one thing about it, if anyone's looking at the imagery, especially uh-huh. out in Maine, and they're really notorious about doing this, especially in the western, the closer you get to Quebec. Okay. And a lot of that area is converted over to pines.
But they manage it that aggressively. If they see a cut that's not producing or regenerating the way they want, they're going to knock it out, start from scratch, and plant something different in there. And they're that aggressive about it.
Yes, they are. And there's good and bad with it. I mean, I understand that you need a resource and something to market later on to return on your investment and to offset the cost of logging. However, you are creating a monoculture if you constantly are putting pine, pine, pine. I see this happening in Ontario. The more pine that you have, the lack of diversity, you lose that because it becomes everything's the same. So when you think about Canada, a lot of their timber industry is pines, 2x4s, lumber, that type of product. And when you have that and you keep losing the aspen or that type of habitat toward planting more and more pine to fill the need for a specific product, you lose the diversity and you lose the ability for these grouse to have huge areas where they were extremely plentiful. They still are plentiful, but they're being pushed into pockets more than anything. So that's a little bit of what's happening in the border right up around Quebec and Maine next to New Hampshire.
Okay.
And you can see it in the imagery. So when I was getting at is when they herbicide an area, it goes to a yellowish color and the ground will look like it was smooth. And then what you have to do after a while, try to find some imagery that's maybe 5, 6, 7 years older. Then you will see the line of pine trees on the imagery. And they did a little bit of that up here in Michigan. I don't know why in their right mind, some of these places were planting tamarack.
Okay.
Yeah, that's when I said, okay. I don't know what the market was at that time, but that's what they did. The imagery will have a different look to it. And it just has a pale yellowish green color.
Let's talk about woodcock. And there was a lot to talk about last week. I mean, they were on the singing grounds. They're starting to do their thing. What have you seen this week? But just as importantly, what's about to happen to these little fellas as you're going to get all this snow moving in?
Well, they're going to have to go under the pines. That's not going to help if a hen's nesting. Because she doesn't nest under the pines. This isn't good. She'll end up going off the nest. There's a really strong chance of that. So what a person needs to do, and everyone has different areas that they hunt, is look at the snow depth map. More than likely, they'll still have that going. And you can see the bands of color of how much snow was in different areas. And that will definitely affect the woodcock. The good thing about it is it's a heavy, wet snow. It's going to warm up after Tuesday for quite a while. And I apologize to people. My dogs are in here, so you're going to hear.
We wouldn't have it any other way.
What's funny is Pierre just woke up out of his sleep with a bark. So anyways, but these birds are going to have a really difficult time. And I feel bad for them because this is not what they were expecting to have happen. So you're going to need to look at your snow depths after this. And then they can re-nest, but and we're early enough that this could happen. But it's not a good thing. I hope they're wrong with that depth of that forecast. They were not calling for multiple days of 3 to 5. So that just got changed.
Yeah. No, it's getting crazy this year. You talked about Pierre. Is this one of the dogs you got from France?
Pierre is all French lines. He's out of a dog called Izard. And Izard was and is. I got to meet Izard and have my picture taken with the handsome dog. He's basically a beautiful, dark, square head, nice jaw setter. But this setter, Izard, he did something that no other dogs have done in France. And he won the competition in the mountains in France and in Switzerland. Some dogs only win them in one country, like Italy. But he won it in two countries. And then he won it in other classes, you know, woodcock, other areas competing. So it was on different disciplines. And yet, what's cool is he did it 2 years in a row.
Wow.
So Pierre and Pascal and Solan are out of Izard. So that's a big name over there.
And have you seen a trial over there? And how do they run a trial? What's that like?
Well, it's the big trial that happens at the end of the year and runs from November into December is 4 days on, 2 days off, 4 days back on. And it starts out with about 300 dogs. There'll be people from different countries there as well. And they run a solo. And I spent more time around the solo area with those dogs. So the gentleman releases the dog, and the dog starts casting. These are wide cast. The judge is also looking for the dog to swing back in front of him. Out, then come back again. Out, then come back again. And they're listening to the bell. Tong, tong, tong. And they're deeper tone bells than what we have here. So then all of a sudden, the bell goes quiet. Then everyone hustles over there. And it's not like there's this huge gallery. There's probably like maybe 6, 7, 8 of us. But they hustle over there. And the dog is young, and it's expected to want to be steady to wing and shot. But it's a shot is with a starter pistol, is what they're using. And if that dog moves, if that dog chases, you're out. You cannot move. So that's what's expected of a young dog. But it's even what they do in the braces. You have two dogs running, and they expect both dogs to perform equally well. And so the deal is, if your dog is performing great, steady to wing and shot, and the other dog breaks, you're both out.
Wow.
Yeah,
no
it's
pressure.
Pretty harsh. No pressure. And you hope you don't end up with someone that has a bad dog.
Yeah.
The European woodcock's more like our grouse. They don't hold like our woodcock. They move. Those birds can be close to a pound. And they have like almost a 22, 23 inch
wow.
wingspan. They're big. An amazing bird. And when they get up, they don't go straight up and out. They zigzag a little bit. So a dog may go on point thinking the bird's there, but you really have to define the quality of the scent. So that dog needs to realize this scent is not as strong as what I have 20 feet ahead. And how much am I taking in? You have to be very stylish. And these are the old setter lines. They're not going to have the tail straight up. That's what setters use. They'll crouch low. I've seen dogs literally come out of the woods, hit the trail of sorts going through like an estate, and all of a sudden go to cast back in and airborne drop to the ground flat on point. It's amazing to watch. They have a lot of speed. Dog also has to be aware where the owner is. These areas where they run them, they might have groups going out into all different parts of these areas that are set aside for the competition. And I was out there with them, and this is my first time over there, and I'm looking at the woods, and I'm saying, okay, that's a beech. Okay, this must be a type of an alder. And I got to see the different heights of when it was cut and that. So yeah, there's a type of an alder, but they get really big too, like a tree. Then there's mistletoe. that was there. You didn't want to run into that. But there was all these ditches. And I'm like, why are these all these ditches in this wood? And finally, I asked Hervé, and he said, well, they used to farm this hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And so that was all hand dug. It just sort of blew my mind, really, how far you were stepping back in time. And we went to an actual estate, mm-hmm. and there was tapestry on the wall. And the table was freaking long. It wasn't a normal size table. Of course, and then everyone's getting served wine. And it was just an incredible experience. But everyone's very passionate about these dogs. But the club has right around 2,500 members, which is huge. And yeah, the dogs, there's over 7,500 setters registered, I think. It's been around since the late 1800s. So there's a lot of history and passion that goes into those dogs over there.
And is it just setters, or are there other of the continental breeds that compete in this, or is it strictly a setter thing?
You might see a pointer, but it's mainly setters is what you see. But it's pretty cool.
Wow. And you told me, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, you told a story about your trip over there and walking through a cow pasture at night. This might be a really good time. This might be a really good time to tell that, because it was cool. It really was.
So the guy said, make sure you bring warm clothing for tonight. I don't speak French. So I'm just trying to say, we don't come back to the house. You know? So, okay, we have a surprise for you. Okay, so we end up going over there to a gentleman that I had two puppies as well that I came back with. So one of the pups came from him. So we were at his house, and I saw the kennel, and then we're eating and drinking more wine and all that. And, you know, I was so starved for a dog in the house, I was sitting on the floor with his dog. Because it was just like, at least the dog wasn't speaking French to me. Not that I'm against French, but if you don't speak French, it's like you're on an island, you know. So anytime anyone speak English, it was like, thank God, there's someone to talk to. So long story short, I was sitting on the floor with the dog. It was beautiful tricolored setter. And everyone's eating. I had already eaten quite a bit. And they just keep eating and drinking wine. And they said, we have a surprise for you again. I said, okay. They're not here yet. Well, that tells me there means it's more than one. So next thing I know, in walks three gals. I said, and they said, this is your surprise. And I'm like, and I said, well, it's nice to meet you. I'm sorry, I don't speak French. And he goes, oh, that's okay. We speak a little English. And then that's when one of the guys explained to me, these gals, they do the European woodcock count. And they go out every evening during the winter time, and they have places they go to, and they count the European woodcock. And they take measurements, and they wait, and they band them as well. We were going to go and see that. And that was just awesome, because these are bigger, much bigger than the American woodcock. And the other gentleman that owned the place, he says, they're always in my backfield. So we start heading out there, and they have like a cage that's about 4 foot long and probably a foot and a half wide, and it's arced up, you know, like almost like vaulted, like it had a vaulted ceiling.
Okay.
And it was wire mesh, and they had this long, long pole, and the pole was very lightweight, and it could be assembled together. And it was probably almost 25 feet long. And so what they would do is one gal would go with the person that was shining the light, and she would be carrying the net. And the other one stayed back with me and would explain what was going on. And so as it'd shine over the field, they'd see the eyes, and then they'd keep the light on there, and then they would go ahead, and we would hold back so as to not make any noise. then they would slowly bring, and after, you know, the birds looking at them, and they'd slowly bring from the top down the cage. We had 8 or 9 birds that night, and they banded a few. And of course, when they get them, they pick them up and hold them very carefully, and they do the measurements, the weight, and they look at the feathers, and they're writing everything down. And they keep track of all this, and they put the band on there. And then we got to, like, the second one, and they said, "Do you want to hold it in?" I said, "Well, sure I do." You know, so they handed the European woodcock over to me, and I was just amazed at how big it was, how big the bill was and everything. And then they said, "Now, when you release it, you get down by the ground and sort of put it lightly on the ground and just hold it for a little bit so it settles, and then pull your hands back and let it go." And you did it, just woof, up in the air to go. But I mean, it's like the bird got up right in front of your face. And wow. It was pretty cool. So, and it was frosty that night. It was really cold for sure for over there. And it was just, we kept seeing birds go up. Some you could get close to, others you couldn't. But that was the last thing I ever thought I'd have the opportunity to do. I wasn't expecting to even be able, I mean, to hold one on top of it was yeah. Like, oh, this is awesome. So it was one heck of an experience. It was really cool.
And again, this is a much bigger bird than right. The woodcock that we are accustomed to. I mean, darn near double the size.
And they got different colorations. They spend a lot of time in the woods, and they do spend time in the fields. But it's just, you'd find areas that reminded you a little bit of when you were trying to find woodcock here. And there'd be chalk all over the ground. And usually it was a little moist area with like an old stream had gone through there. And it wasn't far from a pasture. It was a loafing area for them. They also eat worms. So, and they do eat a little bit of grain, and they eat yesterday a little bit of seeds and things like that, and some invertebrates. So that was one of my experiences over there.
And that's, and again, you're over there because the origin of your line is over there.
Yep. I have dogs from the UK, from New Zealand, and from France and Italian lines as well.
Okay.
I tend to, some women buy shoes. I have dogs.
You accumulate dogs.
Yes.
So I've sporty Italian dogs.
Well, no, they're mostly, I mean, see, when they, nowadays, I have dogs that were from France, but the bloodline also has a qualification of how much percentage Italian, and I have some that are 100, and I have some that are a little bit less, but I'm more interested in a dog that can be, like, dual purpose, not just running the huge fields like a lot of the Italian dogs do, mm-hmm. and running huge distances, but are really more of a working dog. And so I've sought out bloodlines with the help of some key friends over there that have sort of geared me toward what I have now in my kennel. And the biggest surprise was I got over there and one of the guys went over and talked to another gentleman. He says, "Anne," and he goes, "The American?" "Yes, Anne, the American. She has the brother to your female," because this was a son of Natan, and that's a big deal over there. Well, what ends up happening, he also owned the brother, and the brother went on this year to be the European champion. So I have the brother to the European champion for this year from over in Europe. So I never dreamed I'd have something like that. That's sort of like a friend says, "Anne, I think you could fall into a mud pie and come out like you didn't even have it on you." And I said, well, I was telling him, he says, "How in the heck did you pull that one off?" I said, "I didn't. It just happened."
No. Take full credit, whether you knew it or not.
Yeah. So it's
always take full credit.
So I look at Mr. Nagel and I said, "Nagel, you're an expensive dog now. Don't get any ideas."
Oh, hey, what are you doing with training dogs and pups this year? What do you have going?
Well, the litter came early. So the litter was born on the 28th of January, which I haven't had a litter that early in a long time. So at 8 weeks old, there were 7 of them. They went home with the families, and then are going to be back here in about a couple weeks when it gets a little bit warmer and maybe the snow decides to leave.
You're making assumptions now.
Yeah, I'm not going to take the plow off this next time. It'll be 70 degrees and I'll be running with the plow on the front of the UTV. So, but anyways, I like to do quail in the woods. And most of my woods in certain areas are hardwoods, and that's not where I'm going to find grouse anyways, nesting or woodcock nesting. So I have a good area to do that, to release the quail and let them run around. And I have some other areas where I can work on scenting, but I just basically will be doing started pups for these people, and they'll go home just before October.
Oh, okay.
So
you send them home basically to bond with the family, but then they're going to come mm-hmm. back. You're going to train them right up till hunting season, pretty much.
Yep. I'll train them right up there close to hunting season. And, you know, at that point, you're looking at between a 6 to 7 month old puppy mm-hmm. that has been worked in the woods exclusively, that will be working the scent, it'll be shot around, it'll be worked on retrieving. I'll start the housebreaking again before the owners receive it, even though they've done the house training. You go backwards on house training when you put a dog back in the kennel, especially at that age. So I'll reintroduce that again. Puppies are extremely well socialized. Some of the puppies have already been on the water, and it's just a lot of exposure that the owner can do, but then they don't have the ability to do the woods work like what I do.
Well, even socialization sometimes can be, you know, as a guy that has two dogs, not living in the woods, socialization can be an issue. You've got to go out of your way to have your dog spend time with other people, other dogs. You know, mm-hmm. if there's a training day in the area, you know, that's a really, really good opportunity for your dog to get used to other dogs. We've all seen hunting dogs that spend a lot of time with their owner, were very, very well trained, but weren't so great once they got around other dogs. Maybe you went on that big trip out west and two other guys and they had their pups, and sometimes it doesn't go that well. So that whole socialization thing is really, really important, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And I think it helps by sending it back to the family. It becomes a more of a well-rounded pup before it mm-hmm. comes here. And coming back here is like coming back home too. So it's a familiar place.
Hey, could you talk a little bit about training this time of year? And I don't know that we want to get into this too deep, but most of us, now the snow is going away. Mm-hmm. Those of us that are in our various groups or clubs, there's a pointing dog club not far from where I am that I've been a member of on and off for many years. We all start working on things. Mm-hmm. And most of us don't have puppies. Most of us have a 3, 4, 5, 6 year, sometimes older dog. We're starting to do some remedial work. Talk a little bit about that. Let's talk maybe specifically just about steadying as we start to get into our spring training regimen.
Well, especially here in the U.S., there's a lot of different ways that people steady up their dogs. You see the barrel. You see, you know, a half hitch. I start usually with a crate. You open the door, you know, as you're opening the door, you time and time you say, whoa. And you expect that dog to stay there. And so if it starts to barge out, it meets a door.
Yes.
its nose tends to bump the door. And then it goes back in and it looks at you like the door just attacked me. And then what I do at that point is typically the dog's not going to come flying out, but it's going to come out slowly. So what I do is I say easy. So I'm introducing a command there for when I want to release my dog. So I have whoa. And then it blows that out of the water, because all of a sudden it's going to charge out of the crate. And so you send it back there, and then you say whoa. And then when you do that, then as the dog stands there, you say okay or whatever you're going to do. And then I say easy. And then I have a hand out a little bit, so that if my hand goes toward the dog, it slows down. And if it's And I keep it back by me. So I work on a couple things for releasing and for basically wooing a dog. Because it was really important when clients for hunting, for guiding, that the dog wooed, because not every client good at going through the woods and getting to the point. dog had the role. So there's that. And one of the things that a lot of guys do and gals, they'll say, whoa, 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 whoa. Say it just once.
18 times.
Yeah. Yeah. Just say it once. The dog heard you. And I'll relate that to running sled dogs. You did not want to talk to your dogs. At least I didn't when I was running sled dogs, because if you did, when you really needed to give that gee, haw, or whoa command, all they heard was blah, 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 blah. Your words didn't carry any weight. You give the command once, maybe twice, but don't keep saying it. At that point, you need to do, if you have to give it more than that, then you have to do a reset. Pick the dog up or do something or start over or whatever. You don't want to get in the habit of doing that, of saying multiple times the command and waving your hands, because that's confusing to a dog. You want a precise command, give it, and the dog does what you want it to do. But like there's a gentleman, a good friend of mine, and he means well, but the dog's behind the seat of the pickup truck. And he's trying to get the pup, young dog, or the pup out. Whoa, whoa, whoa. And the more he says whoa, the more the hand's going out, and the more he's starting to lean over the top of the dog with that hand going, boing, 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 back and forth. And I'm like, I think we should start over. And the dog's like, to heck with this, I'm just going. So I said, can I do something? He says, yeah. And so I picked her up and put her back in there. And I said, and he had her in a crate. And I said, we're going to fix this. So she came out. She was going to barrel out on me. She hit the door. And she went and she sat down. And I left the door open. And she didn't budge. And I talked with her, and then she came out nice. So, but it's we don't realize how confusing we really are to these dogs sometimes. And of course, when we get excited, and I'm just as guilty. I mean, the hand points back to me as much as it points out. I'm just as guilty. If I get panicky or excited, I gotta watch myself, because it's so easy to throw in an extra command that I shouldn't be saying. Mm-hmm.
Oh, and they read us really well. I mean, they read our body language amazingly well. They know exactly what we're thinking.
Yep, that's for sure. I mean, patterns. Everything with these dogs is patterns, and you have to make sure that you avoid creating a pattern unless it's one that you want. And that's the hard part.
You mean like walking to the back hall, grabbing your boots, and then the dog's doing pogo springs at the back door?
Yeah, something like that.
I think we've all seen that one. Or the training collar. If you get the training collar out, and a couple of days ago I got my training collars out. My wife had taken the dogs to run, and one of them had not been charged. And, she will beep the dog sometimes just to change directions. And she said, well, we've got to charge that. I went over and pulled them out and walked over to where we charged them. And I had two really attentive dogs, because they thought they were going somewhere. That's fun for them.
Oh, sure. It is. It's always fun. It's interesting, the patterns that can unintentionally be created. And it's like, even when you are training, don't put the birds in the same place. Don't expect them to point at the same distance every time. They're not using their nose completely. You're teaching them to point on a certain level of scent. Instead of less scent, you're asking them to point on more scent. And for a grouse, you want to point on less, not more.
Less scent. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, again, this is the time of year we all start to train, and it's great to hear that sort of thing. So, before we kind of close, let's just take it full circle a little bit and talk about, and again, it's complicated because of the snow, but we also have some good weather coming up later in the week. What do you see happening in the woods in the next week or two?
Well, I'll just say in the next week, we're looking out, that snow is supposed to go away. Hopefully we don't have flooding again, but we're under another flood watch. We've had flood watches for 4 weeks off and on. I hope we don't lose the culverts again. I'm more concerned about the woodcock. At least it's not bitter cold. That's a big deal there. Because if it was bitter cold with all that snow, I mean, it's bad enough the snow, but if it was, I mean, lows are 30s. Tuesday morning, or actually, excuse me, Wednesday morning, it'll be 25. It'll probably force any female off the nest, if they have a nest. As far as the grouse, they're just getting started mating. And she hasn't laid any eggs yet. So we should be okay there. And then it's supposed to go in the 60s, so by then I can probably put the snowplow away.
Again.
Again.
You're going to get really good at that.
It's not that hard to do, but it's it's just like, really? I guess the good part is I didn't take the weight out of the back of the box on the UTV. I kept it there. I've got about 75 pounds on that back there, so I don't have to put chains on the tires. At least I didn't have a brainstorm and say, oh, I should get rid of that too.
Now, I'll leave that there for at least a couple of weeks. Don't jinx us. Just leave the weight back there.
I'm going to leave the weight back there.
So, one of the things that you really wanted to accomplish with this podcast is to allow people to email with questions, and I can pose them to you and you can answer them. Can you give an email address that people can leave questions for?
Sure. It's our website, www.mobilehuntingmaps.com, and just go to the contact form and just put a question in there. And then we'll look at answering that on the podcast. This is as much your guys' podcast as it is mine, because it's out there for you guys. It's about trying to help people get the most out of their hunts. Everything I've done has been basically geared toward that. Basically, be able to plan, be able to execute that hunt, look at your weather, and being able to compensate however you need to still hold everything together and have a successful hunt.
Fantastic. Thank you. Forward to doing this in the next week or two. And thank you. Have a wonderful evening. And everybody remember to hunt the habitat.
Thanks again, Steve.
Take care now.
You too.